Support for Central Florida Public Media comes from Addition Financial, offering their Savings Plus account with a 4% annual percentage yield. Serving Central Floridians since 1937 and was recently named one of Newsweek's best regional credit unions. More at additionfi.com/NPR. Applicable on savings up to $5,000. Rate subject to change, federally insured by NCUA.
Checking in on commercial space. You're listening to Are We There Yet? The radio show exploring space exploration. Hi, I'm Brendan Byrne. NASA is working with private industry to handle the day-to-day business of space, like delivering supplies to the International Space Station. One of those companies will soon be Sierra Space. We'll speak with Sierra Space CEO Tom Weiss about the company's plans for its Dream Chaser space plane and how private industry is giving NASA a hand when it comes to business in low Earth orbit. Then, industries throughout the global economy are feeling the impacts of supply chain issues, and the aerospace world is not immune to these challenges. But one commercial space leader argues the aerospace supply chain problem is a bit different than other sectors of the economy. We'll speak with Morpheus Space co-founder and president István Lorenz about the unique challenges and possible solutions to supply chain issues in the aerospace world. The business of space, that's ahead on Are We There Yet? Here on WMFE, America's Space Station. The International Space Station will shut down by 2030. NASA announced plans to decommission the orbiting lab and hopes the private sector will help fill in the gap. One commercial space player hoping to build the next space station is Sierra Space. The company is building a space plane, Dream Chaser, that will resupply the International Space Station for now, but it has greater ambitions in low Earth orbit. To talk more about the future of low Earth orbit and Sierra Space's Dream Chaser, we're joined by Tom Weiss, the company's CEO. Tom, thanks for joining us.
Yeah, thank you for having me. It's a pleasure to be here with you.
So, Tom, we heard from NASA that the agency plans to decommission the International Space Station by the 2030s, relying on the commercial sector to step in and fill that gap. I want to first start by talking about Sierra Space's plans for filling that gap with a commercial space station. What's on the horizon?
Yeah, you know, we're really excited. We have formed a great partnership with the Blue Origin. Sierra Space and the Blue Origin team are very focused. We've gone through a number of inner milestones already, and we're focused on Orbital Reef, which is the name of our space station. It'll be open on orbit, open for business in 2027. So we're really excited about it.
I think back to the design and the building of the International Space Station, which was this massive undertaking. Required international collaboration, took years to get the parts up into space. Looking forward, what are some challenges going into building a space station? This is not an easy feat, I would imagine.
No, it isn't. And what makes the commercial space station Orbital Reef just in our mind a station in which will drive the commercialization of LEO is the significant reduction in cost. The reduction in complexity, the number of launches, and again, we're very differentiated approach for maintaining and operating the station, the Orbital Reef. So the big elements that make this really successful is the fact that we have a series of modules that are a part of an architecture that just continues to use the same modules to keep growing the station. In a central module for us is our life habitat, our large, inflatable, flexible environment we call life. And life is a structure that we can launch inside of a traditional fairing today, whether that fairing is a 5-meter fairing, 7-meter, or 9-meter. And it expands on orbit. So in the case of our Life 1 module, the first iteration of life, we can put it up on a 5-meter fairing, and it literally grows into a 3-story building on orbit. Each life module itself is 1/3 the entire usable volume of the International Space Station in a single launch. And so I think that is, again, the space station has done some incredible things over the years and just a marvel of technology. But we have now the technology and the engineering. It's given us now the ability to build flexible structures that allows us now to significantly drop the cost of access to space. And that's what we're really excited about.
Mm-hmm. So this kind of technological development is helping you with these hurdles. I mean, are there lessons learned from the International Space Station that you're applying to Orbital Reef?
Oh, absolutely. So the Sierra Space and Blue Origin team on our team is Boeing. And Boeing has been involved in design and operations of the International Space Station for decades. So we got, part of our team, we've got the ability to really think about all the things that went well and all the things that were challenging, what drove the cost of operations. You know, an astronaut's time on the space station, the ISS, a lot of their time is just dedicated to make sure that we keep the ISS maintained and flying. So we get to take advantage of all those lessons learned, different ways of doing things. And every one of those lessons learned are being applied to Orbital Reef. And I think that's a huge advantage that we have as a team.
Mm-hmm. And you said 2027 was the date I heard you mention. Is that for the first piece to be in orbit or for the first astronauts to step on board? But when might that actually happen?
Yeah, so we're on orbit in 27. We like to say we're not just on orbit, we're open for business. And so we can see, astronauts going up to the Orbital Reef as early as that year. We also see then the fact that you mentioned earlier that the ISS now is planned to be decommissioned in 2030. Of course, that's assuming that the Russians certify their modules past 2024. But that gives us time to be up on orbit. We're open, and then we get a smooth transition from the ISS over to Orbital Reef. So we're going to be sending cargo and crew up to Orbital Reef in 2027. And that matches up with our Dream Chaser. Dream Chaser is the innovative transportation system that then serves the Orbital Reef space station. So right now, our first cargo variant of Dream Chaser will launch early next year to the ISS. And of course, that cargo variant will also be servicing our space station. We went through a major milestone on our crewed variant of Dream Chaser, and we'll fly that for the first time in 2025. And it'll be human rated flying people to space to support the Orbital Reef in 2027.
Mm-hmm. I want to talk a bit about Dream Chaser in a moment, but I want to go back to Orbital Reef. Is the Dream Chaser going to be the only vehicle that can dock with the station, or will other space vehicles be able to supply cargo and crew to Orbital Reef?
Yeah, no, we've architected Orbital Reef to have standard berthing ports and docking stations, so that other cargo and other crew vehicles can come up and dock with Orbital Reef. That was important to us to make sure that we had the ability for international customers or other companies that have cargo and crew to come up to our station. And so that's built into the architecture and the design. Having said that, we believe that the unique advantages associated with a Dream Chaser space plane that can fly a significant amount of cargo and crew and come back and land on a runway literally anywhere in the world of 737 at a nice low G is a unique advantage that space planes have, and the Dream Chaser specifically has. But again, we've designed Orbital Reef with standard docking and berthing ports.
Mm-hmm. Let us talk about Dream Chaser now. I've been covering space for quite a few years here in Florida, and have gotten to see the development of this vehicle over those years. You said it's getting ready to fly cargo soon, getting ready to fly crew soon. Give us a status on this. What work is left to do, if there's any?
Yeah, so right now on our first, what we call our cargo variant of Dream Chaser, you might have heard it called DC-100. It is in our factory here in Louisville, finalizing its integration and test. The next phase for that vehicle is to get to Neil Armstrong Test Facility and go into TVAC testing and other testing at NASA. And then the vehicle then is shipped from Neil Armstrong to Kennedy Space Center and then prepared to integrate onto the Vulcan rocket. And again, we anticipate that it'll be up to the ISS early next year. So we're within a year, much less than a year, of having Dream Chaser have its first cargo resupply mission to the International Space Station.
Mm-hmm. It really is a cool looking spacecraft, for sure. But there is a reason why it is in that space plane design. Can you just remind us as to some of the advantages of having a vehicle that can launch on a rocket but can land on these aircraft runways upon return?
Yeah, I mean, you know, the Dream Chaser looks the way it does. It's both a spacecraft and an airplane, and it's a very high speed airplane as it reenters the Earth's atmosphere. You know, it's flying at hypersonic speeds, supersonic, subsonic, and so has all of the capability of advanced aerodynamics and drag reduction. But its unique aspects is that it can bring things back to Earth in a very low G reentry. And again, land at any runway, anywhere in the world a 737 can land. So for us, imagine that we return and we land at Kennedy Space Center, and you know, delicate scientific research is able to quickly get out of our space plane back into NASA, again, without having to be plunged into the ocean or, you know, a capsule that lands somewhere in the middle of a desert. So quick access, reentry. The other aspect of Dream Chaser is the fact that it's highly reusable, a minimum of 15 times, and uses a fuel that's non-hypergolic. Again, so all the hazardous issues associated with other, like the space shuttle, for example, we use a different fuel type, an oxidizer type, hydrogen peroxide, and RP1 in this case. And again, that's again allows us to land and easy access to cargo that's on the space plane, or obviously people that's on the space plane, and then back refurbish the aircraft, get it back up into flight, and turn it very quickly.
Mm-hmm. That those first crew missions, do you have a crew picked out? Who will be going? And selfish follow up question: are you taking volunteers?
Great question. We're obviously in discussions with lots of people who want to fly. It'll be the first flight up. We haven't announced that, but we do have our own human space flight office. We have obviously a medical office, astronaut training corps. It's led up by our president, Janet Cavondi. As you know, is a former astronaut. She also ran a Glenn Research Center, and she's both our president and leading up our human space flight office. So we're excited. We've had a number of folks that are very interested in being the first crew up. To your question about volunteers, again, we'd love to talk to you about it. I'll say that I'm very excited to be part of that first crew.
Excellent. Excellent.
That's, of course, if Janet, you know, passes me through the human spaceflight office.
Yeah, right. You got to get through the training program.
I got to get through Janet first.
let's talk finally, Tom, about an issue that I've talked with a few other aerospace companies, and that's recruiting a STEM workforce. It seems to be a challenge these days to get people that have the skills and knowledge to work in this industry. Are you finding similar challenges at Sierra Space? And what's kind of your path forward to get this pipeline filled with candidates that can come and work on these spacecraft and possibly go to space and build these systems in low Earth orbit?
Yeah, I think it's a great question. I mean, we're all seeing that there's a very tight labor market, especially as you look at advanced engineering skill sets, it even gets tighter. I think the key for us is that one is we really are proud of having a vision that's very differentiated, one in which is we believe is going to create a very differentiated outcome in the way that we think about human colonization and obviously commercialization of space. So I think it begins with a company that people can really think about doing something that's very differentiated. It's not just building, you know, another launcher. It's not just building, you know, another widget. It's doing something that is very disruptive and will change the course of how we think about humans going to and from space. So I think you first got to have something that's compelling. We have a great team of recruiters. We're involved in a lot of obviously different parts of the market. And right now, I think we've been successful in attracting the kind of talent you can imagine that we need. Extremely creative, courageous, collaborative, brilliant people that really want to work together. And, you know, right now we're hiring about 30 to 35 people a week.
Mm-hmm. Tom Weiss is the CEO of Sierra Space. Tom, hopefully the next time I see you, we're both strapped into a Dream Chaser.
You bet. All righty. Sounds great.
Thanks so much for chatting with us, Tom.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Still to come, supply chain issues in aerospace are a unique problem. One space leader's idea to fix it. Are we there yet? Is back in a minute. You're listening to Are We There Yet? Here on WMFE, America's Space Station. I'm Brendan Byrne. Industries throughout the global economy are feeling the impacts of supply chain issues, and the aerospace world is not immune to these challenges. But one commercial space leader argues the aerospace supply chain problem is a bit different than other sectors of the economy. We're joined by Morpheus Space co-founder and president, Itzvan Loritz, to talk about the unique challenges and possible solutions to supply chain issues in the aerospace industry. He begins our conversation by explaining that aerospace industry wasn't impacted as much by the pandemic as other industries. Instead, it was the fact that analysts underestimated just how much business the private space sector was capable of, and manufacturers of components for satellites weren't ready for the big business of rockets.
Everybody was basically blindsided by the rockets, and nobody was the majority of the industry was not trying to adapt scalable means because they didn't see the demand there. It was all in projections, and they, you know, nobody acted upon projections. We acted upon projections. We acted upon our own projections that we sensed that there's going to be a big industry in a decade or so.
And so there's not scalability with these components. But when I think of the aerospace industry, I think of an industry that is very enterprising and that is able to, you know, surmount these technical hurdles that are in front of them. Is that the case? Is that what's happening in your industry right now? Is that you're seeing this challenge and then you're meeting it with some sort of solution, or is this really going to hamstring the industry for a while?
Oh yeah. And that's actually what I took upon myself to just go out and just whistleblow all everywhere I can, so that people listen and look at the data. And most importantly, maybe some analysts will listen to this and they will go out and try to gather some way, in an anonymized way, to gather the actual capacity, how many satellites could be built per year, and project that out. Find the bottlenecks, which satellite components are actually causing trouble. Like, we know the propulsion systems are in extremely high demand. Lead times are now slipping into 1.5 to 2 years for a propulsion system in the industry. And this cannot happen. This cannot be, because we are getting requests from big companies that say, well, we need a lot of propulsion systems within like 3 months. Otherwise, we're going to fail the mission. And these things are all impacting the industry. Like, if five missions fall out of a launch, that has an impact. And we need to realize that it's not a huge industry. Like, it's not, 50,000 companies acting here. It's smaller and intimate, so to say. I mean, you see the same faces over and over again at the same conferences. It's not, you know, that big that you can lose your sense of interconnectedness.
Mm-hmm. You mentioned propulsion is something that these satellite manufacturers are looking for. Morpheus Space, that your company specializes in satellite propulsion systems. I mean, how are you, one, meeting the demand of these satellite manufacturers for the parts that they need, and how are you able to get the parts that you need to make your parts to make their parts? You know, how is this working?
So we don't have problems of getting parts, and nobody has serious issues of getting parts. There are some shortages here and there, but I never heard that the problem is that I cannot build enough things because I don't have enough chips or resistors or whatever. What I'm seeing is that the processes to put these basic components together into a propulsion system or into an attitude control system is not scalable, is meant to be manual and you know, absolutely inefficient. It's meant for a low volume production. And everywhere across the board, you see this. There are certain exceptions, obviously. Like I consider Morpheus an exception. And there are other companies like Blue Canyon Technology, for example. They produce a high volume of reaction wheels. Everybody knows that in the industry. However, we also know that that's still not enough. And the industry right now, the legacy industry players are now seeing this same shortage. And what they are expecting is that they are slapping money into the problem or onto the problem, and they are expecting results, but that's not how it works. You have to adapt your product to make sure that you can produce it in high volume. We went through the whole thing and we prepared everything so that we can achieve a production rate of tens of thousands of units per year if needed. You know, we can take money and slap it onto our business and make it bigger, but others can't.
What are some of the challenges then? You know, if money's not going to solve the problem, how do you solve this problem? How did Morpheus Space meet this demand and solve this problem?
You need everybody needs to accept, first of all, the reality of the projections. Even if they project, even if you say that those are wishy-washy and it's not guaranteed, what's guaranteed is the increase. So what you need to focus on is that, well, this year I sold, let's say, 10 or whatever thing I'm building, I sold 10. Well, next year, maybe I'm going to have to sell 20, right? And the year after that, maybe it's, you know, and then it's just adapt an exponential growth curve and project it out like 4 or 5 years into the future and realize that you are not able to meet that demand. If you're not able to grow with the industry, you're going to die out, right? You're going to get fizzle out into non-existence. Like building up factories and having goals of producing 100 units per year is ridiculously low. The companies need to have a higher, higher ambition. And you get that through financiers. So the only way you can actually execute on big ambition is if the financiers also understand that there is a problem and there is a big demand that needs to be met. And all of this will be very, very obvious in like 1 or 2 years. It's going to be obvious, like with the rockets. Everybody knows that. That was like 5 years ago, that was the biggest problem for the growth of the industry. In 2 years, everybody's gonna see that it's subcomponents that's gonna be a problem. But by then, it's gonna be too late.
We're sitting here talking about how one of the challenges of this industry is its exponential growth. that doesn't seem like it should be a challenge. That you want to be in an industry that has exponential growth, right?
But absolutely.
But I mean, absolutely. Are you optimistic?
That's not the problem. The problem is that the people are not recognizing believing their own predictions. Mm-hmm. That's the problem.
Are you optimistic that you say that in the next year or two, it's going to become very clear? Are you optimistic that those subcomponents will be there to meet this demand? Or are these issues that you're raising the alarm bells on not being taken seriously, and this is seriously going to hamstring the exponential growth that you're describing that the aerospace industry has on the horizon?
The main cause for this is the secrecy in the industry. So everybody likes to act behind the veils of NDAs and classified missions and stuff like that. That was all nice and good for the legacy industry that had to protect their lobbying efforts, right? And everything had to be secret. And the more secret it was, the better your results were. In an open capitalistic market, that's not the case. You want to have competition. You want to have the information readily available to everyone in the industry of what's the demand and what's the supply and where are the challenges, where are the holes in the chains, right? Everybody needs to know that because everybody is connected. At the end of the day, we all have a runway. The industry has a runway, right? The new space industry has a runway because it has been pumped with venture capital the past few years. So what we need to make sure is that we utilize that influx of capital and make it profitable as soon as possible. That's the reason for exponential growth. That's why VCs are pushing for exponential growth so that you don't waste time growing slowly, bootstrapping and growing linearly slowly up. No, grow fast up and then make money. Once you reach critical mass, you can do real business, right? And that's what we're seeing. That's the same thing as what if you look at a startup or the entire industry right now, it's statistically speaking, the behavior patterns are similar.
I'm going to end on this question. It's fun. You mentioned that one solution to this and probably the best way to solve this is by these companies being more transparent about projections and getting away from that legacy model with new space. I mean, are you optimistic that will change?
I truly believe that that's going to happen because people like me are going to force this. I'm seeing the problem, and if we would be just a little bit more open, we wouldn't have this problem. If all satellite component providers could, for example, provide a number in an anonymized way of what's their capacity and some entity, some government entity would collect that, you know, and they could just let everyone know, well, you know, the industry can produce right now 1,000 propulsion systems. There you go. You know, just check it out.
That was Morpheus Space co-founder and president, Itzvan Loritz. That's going to do it for this week's show. Be sure to subscribe to the show's podcast feed. Get it on NPR One, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts, or visit wmfe.org/arewetthereyet. Are We There Yet is a production of WMFE, America's Space Station. Editorial guidance this week from LaToya Dennis. Our intern is Caroline Brockler. Support for Are We There Yet comes from our listeners. Until next week, I'm Brendan Byrne. Thanks for listening.